Thanks a lot. Good afternoon, everybody. So the original title was Ferromagnetic and Antiferromagnetic Spintronics, but then I got worried that I will not make it to the antiferromagnetic, so just to make sure I just call it magnetic, and we will see where I get. This is the list of people who are responsible for the work I'm going to talk about, and also I'm going to show you the affiliations here. So our group is very extended, from Prague to Nottingham, Hitachi and University of Cambridge, but also we are getting samples and collaborations from Japan. All the magneto-optical pump and probe studies were done in our joint lab we have between the Institute of Physics and Charles University in Prague. Some of the oxide materials, which these are antiferromagnetics. I'm not sure I'm going to make it there, but we're using the expertise of people like Foncoberta in Barcelona, and the materials were grown in Ramesh group in Berkeley. So I thought that during the talk I will try to make a few comments on what's been already discussed here at this conference, and Garrett gave this nice overview of past and future directions of spintronics research, and he mentioned that ferromagnetic semiconductors like gallium manganese arsenide are kind of losing the interest. And one of the reasons he gave was that it seems like this field is full of controversies, and if there's a field or material which is full of controversies, that could be one of the reasons why you should not be that much interested in this material or in the topic. Well, from my perspective, I think it's a bit reminiscent to the old story of semiconductors, where there were people at the beginning, like Pauli, for example, who were saying in the 40s that you should not work on semiconductors because it's a mess. But eventually, when people learned how to grow it properly, how to use them properly, then semiconductors became useful. And I think to some extent, the story is repeated with the magnetically doped semiconductors. And the prime example is gallium manganese arsenide. So let me just show you a couple of slides on the material side of it, because I think much of the controversy actually originates from how these materials are actually made, and then how the results are interpreted. So I appreciate that all of you, except for Sebastian, are theorists, but let me just show you a few experimental facts or material science facts about this material. So when you want to look at the doping dependence of magnetic and electrical properties of gallium manganese arsenide, you have to grow materials at the different dopings. And this is the percent of manganese. And you should appreciate that we are doping a few percent of an acceptor into a semiconductor host. So that means that you're doping a semiconductor up to 2-3 orders of magnitude, 4 orders of magnitude higher concentration of acceptors or charge impurities than in a conventional semiconductor host. So this is a highly non-equilibrium situation. So it's a rather delicate thing how you grow these materials. And what this first figure shows, it's basically the boundary, the growth boundary between the 2D growth, that's what you want to have in your MBE, you want to grow it layer by layer, and the 3D growth, that's the one that you want to avoid because things start to cluster and you're not getting an epilayer. And as you see, as you increase the nominal manganese concentration, this boundary goes down. So in the growth temperature. And what you want to be at when you grow it, you want to be as close as possible at this boundary rather from the lower side. Here is the 3D growth. But if you're too low in temperature, then it's very non-equilibrium, and you're putting a lot of unintentional defects into your structure, which you have no control pretty much at all, what's going on with the material. So you have to really stick to that growth boundary as much as possible. If you do that, you pull out your material from the MBE system, usually it's not a very good quality material, and what you have to do is a post-growth annealing. The majority of defects that you're removing by that is just the interstitial manganese, which is a compensating defect in this material. And here you see that this is a material grown at about 180 degrees, and you anneal it at temperatures which are very close to the growth temperature. But again, the annealing temperature makes a huge difference. This is the Curie temperature of your material measured for different annealing times and different annealing temperatures. And so you see that you have to optimize both the annealing time and temperature to get the highest possible Curie temperature in that particular material, which in this one reaches the 190 Kelvin. Now this just shows you what you get if you really follow all the optimization procedures. You find the best growth temperature, annealing temperature, time, and this is the sequence that you get. You start with, in this particular optimal growth temperature, you start with a material which is fine, it's magnetic, it's conductive, but you can still improve it a lot. I mean, the TC goes from 75 to 190, and this is the Curie point singularity in transport, which tells you where the TC is, but also the sharpness of the singularity tells you how uniform and not compensated or non-compensated your system is. So you're improving it tremendously. And here is, I just wanted to highlight this to you. This is a material which is grown at exactly the same nominal concentration. Everything is done the same as in this case. The only difference is that the growth temperature is 10 degrees lower. And if you were an MBA grower, you would appreciate that at these growth temperatures around 200 Kelvin, it's very difficult to control the temperature within a few degrees accuracy during the growth. Imagine that you start with a semiconductor, you end up with a metal, so the temperature gradients change dramatically during the growth. So to control the temperature at this degree is very difficult. But what you get 10 degrees below, you get when you pull out your sample, it's a heavily doped, it's an insulator, and it's non-magnetic. So what you can do at this point, you can say, you know, you can engage your theorists and you can try to ask them, hey, what's the reason why this heavily doped semiconductor suddenly becomes insulating and why it's, again, paramagnetic? And you can start to develop various heavily correlated theories because you will never get this in any normal ab initio density functional approach. And you can start to develop various exotic scenarios, how come this material becomes insulating and paramagnetic at these high dopings. To me, the alternative way is actually to, you know, to do a better growth and get at the same doping a material which you know exactly how to control it, and you get a perfectly controlled, perfectly metallic and ferromagnetic material. This is another example, again, optimized, non-optimized, and what happened between those two samples, they are both nominally 7% doped, they are grown at exactly the same temperature, you do exactly the same annealing. Now the only difference between those two layers is this one is thinner than 50 nanometers and this one is thicker than 100 nanometers. So one of the other optimization factors in this growth is that you cannot grow optimal, very nice materials if the thickness of the epilayers is thicker than some threshold, and that threshold obviously depends on the doping. But the rule of thumb is that if you're 50 nanometers below, you can get very nice epilayers. If you're 100 nanometers and above, it's completely impossible to get nice epilayers. And this is an example. So this is your magnetization curve. Again, all the other growth conditions were identical. You have a perfect singular behavior of your magnetization, of your singularity in your transport, very nicely metallic sample. Here, well, the magnetization curve is kind of weird. You don't have a really nice singular behavior. So again, you can start to talk to theorists and explain this unusual magnetization behavior through some percolation physics and highly correlated
physics.
What
curve was what?
So this one is, the red one is magnetization. This is dRho dt, so this is the temperature derivative of the resistance. It basically scales a specific heat, so it's singular. And these are just the simple resistance as a function of temperature. Now, if you go along this, if you do, and I will show you how these experiments are done, if you do magneto-optical pump and probe FMR experiments, from the data you can get, for example, full frequency dependence of your damping factor here. And as you see, at some frequencies and higher, that means higher magnetic fields, you get a perfect constant. So in these materials, you can infer what we call a Gilbert damping, a constant for your damping, intrinsic. If you do the same thing in this non-optimized material, you can never get a constant. So you can start developing, you know, one would do the measurements in the normal FMR at 5 gigahertz, the other one will do it at 15 gigahertz, you will get a completely different Gilbert damping. Then you can start to develop theories, you know, why these Gilbert dampings are different, etc. But, you know, if you are careful with your material, you get a perfectly reproducible at constant value, and there's no question about it. It's perfectly consistent with the band ferromagnet. Here, in these optical pump and probe experiments, you can not only excite the uniform precession mode, but you can also excite in thin films higher spin wave modes here. And if you have a nice thin film material, which is very uniform, homogeneous, you get these perfect Kittel modes, which scale as 1 over length, 1 over width of the film square, or 1 over the square of the mode number. And from these Kittel modes, then you can infer perfectly the spin stiffness parameter. And then you can, you know, you can look at it. Or you take one of these materials, and you can also try to infer spin stiffness, but as you see, there's not even the conserved number of modes which you see in this material as a function of frequency or magnetic field. So again, you can start to develop very unusual exotic theories that will explain this type of spin behavior. You just stick with those materials where everything is under control.
Who's trying to make these difficult theories?
Sorry?
Can you give names?
So this is one example. what can happen?
Let's get with that. That also includes inhomogeneous broadening?
Yes, of course. I mean, the inhomogeneous broadening is something that you see at these lower frequencies that will contribute to the damping. But once you're at high enough frequencies, then this inhomogeneous broadening is not contributing anymore. And you
get extra stuff.
So that extra stuff is inhomogeneous broadening. But in these experiments, which are optical experiments in real time, you get all the Fourier components in frequency automatically. So you can get all the frequencies there. So this is, I really don't want to get into, Garrett, your question in you know, many details, but this is just to show you one example. This is what you get if you want to look at your TC, how it depends on the filling of your band. So that means relative concentration of holes and local moments, right? The normal standard theories of this material, which would be a, like band, ferromagnet, degenerate, heavily doped degenerate semiconductor, tell you that there should not be any collapse of TC near the one hole per manganese concentration. So when there is no compensation in your system, you would expect that the TC will simply go up with the number of holes per manganese. And that's what you get in these samples. Now, I'm not going to say that these samples are bad samples, because in this particular case, these are not samples from our group. But what I can tell you that these samples are thick. You can, you know, refer back to what I've showed you before in the previous slides, what happens in thick samples. All these samples were all grown at one growth temperature. You know, you saw what happens if you grow at different growth temperatures, even by 10 degrees. These are samples which are span the doping from 1 to 12%, all grown at the same temperature. Annealing procedures, all the same for all dopings. And what you get here, there is a collapse of the TC at apparent concentration of holes per local moment, which approaches zero. So now you can start thinking, give it to theories and say, why is there a collapse of TC when I'm getting close to full filling, and why there is a maximum of TC at half filling? And you can start to develop theories, like impurity band theory would, for example, fall into that category. Or you just look at the materials where the growers try to do their best to grow as close as possible materials to the ideal gallium manganese arsenide, and there you don't observe the physics.
You say these basically theoreticians that try to analyze a piece of shit.
Is this recorded? I'm just saying that it's a big part of the story is that theorists were trying to explain materials which were grown not under well controlled conditions.
Right? Yes, diplomatic.
Okay. And I think it's a bit of a waste of time. Right. Now, there's just for your curiosity, this has been done by one type of experiment determining the hole concentration. This was done by a different technique. This is CV profiling. This is Hall effect measurement. You can discuss that. But there are these two star points. These are our materials shipped to these guys doing their experiment and telling us what the numbers were, and there was no collapse. Okay, so it just tells you that this is not about the experimental technique used. It's really about the materials which you have in your hands. And if you then stick to those materials where you are careful how you grow them, how you anneal them, how you prepare, this is what you can get eventually. Over the whole doping range of nominal dopings up to something like 14, you cannot go any further. You cannot introduce more manganese into the substitution position, at least from our experience and the known techniques of growth. This is what you get. At about 1%, you have heavily insulating materials which are paramagnetic. 1.5%, system becomes magnetic, it's ferromagnetic, low Curie temperature, and is just about the metal insulator transition point. And then at about 2%, you know, you have a change in resistivity by several orders of magnitude. And then on that scale, the resistivity is pretty much flat. So it looks like a perfectly well-behaved, doped, degenerate semiconductor which undergoes this metal insulator transition. All these samples are very uniform, have very nice Curie point singularities, which you can scale one to another with increasing TC, with increasing the nominal doping here. All the materials that you prepare by these optimal conditions have pretty much the same concentrations of holes at local moments. So that means you are able to get rid of pretty much of all compensating defects. There is one hole per manganese, and manganese is a single acceptor. So that's type of materials you get.
Will that TC is the world record for bulk materials?
We believe that 190, we believe from all the literature, 190 that we achieve is the record. I mean, you can see in literature people quoting, for example, temperatures which are above 200. But they were inferring this temperature from the maximum in resistivity rather than in magnetization curve or d rho dt. And the maximum can be well above 200 Kelvin, but it's not a TC.
Some delta doping experiment, right?
They had 240, but it was a delta dope from a barrier, never reproduced. I don't think that has any value, that experiment. But for simple bulk, I believe that the 190 is the record. And our feeling is that what limits the TC is that we are not able to get more manganese into the substitution position. We're not getting more moments in there. It's already a huge number of acceptors anyway. So if you have this optimized series of samples, what you get is samples which are perfectly well-controlled micromagnetic parameters, and that's what you want to have if you want to use those for spintronics. These are the cubic magnetic anisotropy constant, uniaxial in-plane, out-of-plane uniaxial constant, Gilbert damping, stiffness, all that behaves very clean, it's fully reproducible. I want to emphasize that you are getting exactly the same numbers when you grow it again and again and again, and not only in one MD machine, if you grow it in Prague, if you grow it in Nottingham, there are differences between the machines, but if you're trying to get the best for the nominal doping by annealing, growth temperature, etc., you will always end up at the same temperature for the same doping material with the same anisotropy. And you see there's a big variation of the anisotropies, also Gilbert damping, identical. So the materials, if you care about the growth and synthesis, they are perfectly reproducible. If you don't, you can get anything you want. Well, for the anisotropies, obviously the substrate is important. These are all grown on gallium arsenide. If you put it on different substrate, you can change the out-of-plane anisotropy right. Due to strain. If you add phosphorus, which we did for domain walls, you can get a nice out-of-plane material. You can play all these three. This is just for the simple bare materials, just to show you the the principle.
Is uniaxial in-plane anisotropy that is understood where it's coming from?
Well, I was not completely.
Oh, what did you do?
I was not absolutely precise when I was saying that you can get all the micromagnetic parameters right on spot when you reproduce the growth, for example, between two chambers. It applies to the cubic, to this constant Gilbert stiffness, but not to the uniaxial. This uniaxial one is actually something which is not intrinsic to the crystal structure. It is connected with the very subtle details of the growth. We have the same sign between Prague and Nottingham, but sometimes there is a factor of 2-4 difference in the uniaxial constant, although all the other constants are the same. there are various scenarios where this originates from, but that would be for a long discussion. It certainly is not a first-order type of anisotropy. It's not intrinsic in the lattice. There are different types of defects which are difficult to get rid of, which may produce it, but it's not. The jury is still out, but it's probably going to be always out, I think. But the point I want to make for the following part of the talk is that the material, when you take care of how you synthesize them, they are perfectly under control, they are perfectly reproducible, they are nice band ferromagnets and degenerate semiconductors, heavily, heavily doped degenerate semiconductors. On top of that, they are very tunable. Many of the micromagnetic parameters, or also the semiconducting properties, you can tune. They are compatible with 3-5 heterostructure and fabrication techniques. That's very important. If you want to move that material to devices, the fact that you have already developed the microfabrication techniques for 3-5s, you really take advantage of that. For us theorists, but also for experimentalists, it's very important that they have very strong exchange and spin orbit coupling energy scales. There are several hundreds of millivolts are the scales. And that implies that even if you have a strong disorder in the material, and that strong disorder could be intrinsic. It's basically that you have this random substitution manganese. They introduce a strong disorder. But you can still have some unintentional disorder. You can have these magnetic films which are not perfect with some compensated defect. Still, you can use it very well for spintronics. And the reason for that is that for what you need for spintronics is some conduction. And they are conductive. They are metallic. And then you need to have strong magnetic and spin orbit coupling effects. And they should be stronger than, let's say, the disorder broadening of your bands. As long as this is fulfilled, then yes, disorder will mix those states, those perfect band states. But as long as you rely on these spin orbit coupling effects, even if you mix them, you know, it's still going to be there. So all these phenomena which originate from spin orbit coupling and strong exchange will survive as long as this disorder is not completely going to destroy the spin orbit splitting of the bands, etc. So the spin orbit splitting, for example, parameters 340 millivolts, Fermi energy is about 300 millivolts, and the broadening, the disorder broadening, is not reaching those values. It's certainly strong mixing, but it's not destroying it, and that's why you can use it. And the other thing, because of this, many of the, for example, residual resistivity, you can never get from a simple Born approximation, right? Born approximation will underestimate the residual resistivity by a factor of 10, maybe. But many of the spintronic effects, which are the relative effects, how does the resistivity change when I change the magnetization orientation, for example, AMR? That's the thing that depends on the exchange splitting and spin orbit coupling in the bands. And this, you can get very well even from the first order Born approximation, because the mixing due to the disorder is not going to change dramatically those spintronic or exchange spin orbit coupling induced effects. Same applies for magnetic anisotropy, etc. So even though it's a heavily disordered system, you can still rely on the conventional band structures from DFT, tight binding, or even some semiconductor KDP type of models with perturbatively accounted disorder in there, and you can get many of the spintronic effects on a qualitative or even semi-quantitative level.
May I ask a question? Yeah. Do you mean that a Richard band approximation would be enough to consider all the effects that you have in mind?
I'm not sure. I know what rigid band approximation is, of course, but. that's not what you do, for example, when you do the DFT theory of this. You don't have a rigid band approximation. You just do CPA or you do supercell, so you don't rely on rigid band approximation. the same thing is, for example, even in this K.P theory, if you add more manganese, if you add more carriers, you also change the exchange splitting, spin orbit coupling, warping, and all that. So, I mean, it's not that you have one band and then you move your Fermi level depending on the carrier concentration. None of these theories do it like that. So.
But at which point do you do a Born approximation then? If you just put the defects in the electronic structure calculation, I don't see where you do the Born approximation.
No, I was
but
not talking.
You do it for the resistivity.
Exactly. I was not doing it about electronics. You can do electronic structure with CPA, and then you automatically have an imaginary part of your spectral function. But you can do just a normal band structure without any disorder, virtual crystal, or you do supercell calculations if you want. KDP is virtual crystal approximation. And then when you calculate the transport, then you add Born approximation disorder, for example. So, if I convinced you that that this material, gallium-manganese arsenide, can be made in a way that it's reproducible and it's a well-controlled degenerate and band semiconductor, it would not itself make it a valuable material, because there are many materials like that. I mean, there are many materials which you can control well and which are nice band ferromagnets and and maybe even have semiconducting properties. But what I want to show you here in the next few slides is there's a few examples where I think gallium-manganese arsenide really played an important role in opening new directions in spintronics research, which went well beyond the gallium-manganese arsenide. And this has been happening from the very beginning of the story of gallium-manganese arsenide, and it's still happening today. And this is the main reason. The fact that we have material we can very well control, it's not enough. But the fact that we have material which is given us, or we can use it as a nice test-bed material where we are discovering new effects. That's the reason why we are keeping this material in our MD machine, and we're planning to keep that material for, let's say, next decade, because it's still coming up. So let me just show you a few examples where I think that gallium-manganese arsenide play an interesting role. This one example is anisotropic magnetoresistance. I think from the discovery of the effect in mid of 19th century all the way to 2004, all what people knew about AMR was just the ohmic AMR. You take a piece of wire, a magnetic wire, you change the magnetization orientation, and you change the resistance, ohmic resistance. I think that was all what people would have in terms of AMR. In gallium-manganese arsenide, what people did, they took a piece of gallium-manganese arsenide, on top of that deposited a barium, Alox barium, and on top of that a gold counter electrode. So we just make a tunneling device with just only one magnetic electrode, contrary to the before conventional tunneling magnetoresistance devices where you had two ferromagnetic electrodes and you change the relative orientation. Here, there's just one magnetic electrode, and what you do, just like in AMR, you change the absolute angle of the magnetization with respect. Current direction, crystal direction, with some specific direction in your experiment. And what you've got in this experiment was, again, a magnetoresistance curve. This one looked pretty much like the normal tunneling magnetoresistance with two ferromagnets, but you already see that there is some interesting new feature in it. If you change the angle of the magnetic field, if you rotate your magnetic field and then sweep the magnetic field, you can get a positive and negative sign. So it already has an additional feature which you cannot get in the normal TMR signals, at least in the conventional geometry. But still, the signal here was a few percent, so maybe from that perspective, not that very interesting. But then, soon after, again, the same gallium manganese arsenide. Now you make a little more sophisticated device. This is a device where you have a thin constriction here. So basically, the transport is single electron-like. You put a side gate, and again, you just measure AMR. You change the angle of your magnetization, sweep your magnetic field. And now, instead here of changing the angle, what I'm showing you are two curves for two different applied gate voltages on the side gate. Two messages from this experiment. First message is that this magnetoresistance signal, if you can read the numbers, you can basically, it's 10^2x, and you can put any x you want. You can have 10,000, 100,000 magnetoresistance effects. But basically what happens is that while you're rotating your magnetization in the system, you're opening and closing this single electron transistor. So basically from zero resistance to conductance, or from zero conductance to conductive channel. And that you can make of any size. So for us, this was a conceptual step, because up to this year, I think it was a general perception that AMR is bound to be small. And if you want to have a large magnetoresistance, you have to go to this non-relativistic tunneling magnetoresistance, for example. AMR is always relativistic. It's always going to be a small correction to transport. No, you can have magnetoresistance, which is thousands of percent high, if you just have appropriate geometry of your device. And this just
temperature.
Well, this temperature is governed by the temperature at which you can operate a single electron transistor, which is intrinsically low. It's around 1 Kelvin in this particular experiment. But I'll show you just in a second that this is just, it's not limited by the magnetic part of it. It's just limited by the electronic part of your transistor, which you use in this particular experiment. And the other message you can get that you can have an electrically tunable magnetoresistance signal, right? So you can combine the things that you're used to in semiconductors with the things that you're used to in spintronics. Now, this inspired immediately trying to look for TMR effects in transition metal ferromagnets, started in Regensburg with iron, moved to other cobalt platinum materials, etc., and all the way up to demonstration of this tunneling and isotropic magnetoresistance in an antiferromagnet. So this is an antiferromagnetic film next to the tunnel barrier. So here, the fact that we can have a large, sizable, anisotropic magnetoresistance effect, that was extremely important when we started thinking about antiferromagnets. Because in antiferromagnets, you're not going to have the standard tunneling magnetoresistance-like effect when you have a relative orientation of magnetization of two components. That simply doesn't work in a straightforward way in antiferromagnets. But rotating your ordered spins with respect to current or some lattice axis in your system, it doesn't really matter whether you have parallel or antiparallel. It's conceptually, it's identical. And since we knew that in principle you can have large effects, the idea came to try to use these type of effects to see, to get magnetoresistance effects in antiferromagnets. So as you see in this guy, we had 160% tunneling and isotropic magnetoresistance in an antiferromagnet. This direction here led to another conceptual realization or progress. So what has been done here, this was a single electron transistor, and the basic physics behind this phenomenon is that as you rotate the magnetization, you change your density of states. Your density of states are anisotropic. They change when you rotate the magnetization because of spin orbit coupling. And what you rely on in this tunneling experiments is basically the tunneling the tunneling density of states changes. So it's the density of states times the matrix elements from one side to the other, and they can be anisotropic. In this experiment, in this transistor experiment, the the quantity that governs the transport is just one single property or parameter that you derive from an isotropic density of states, and that is the position of the chemical potential in your structure. And when we realize that this magnetoresistance is just governed by the shift of the chemical potential when you rotate magnetization, we thought, maybe we don't have to have our magnet in the transport channel. Maybe we can just remove the magnet from the transport channel, put it in the capacitively coupled gate, and try to see to do exactly the same experiment. We used the same gallium manganese arsenide, just to have a reference, and we saw exactly the same thing. We have a single electron transistor, which now is a simple aluminum single electron transistor. Now we control it with this magnetic gate. When we fix the externally applied gate voltage and we just rotate the magnetization, we can open, close this single electron transistor. So at the beginning, Yaroslav had this question, what is spintronics? How should we define spintronics? So I think one way how to define spintronics is go to Wikipedia. And Wikipedia tells you that spintronics is spin transport electronics. I don't think that dwelling on those definitions and terminology is so important, but look at this device. There is a perfect logical step from the ohmic AMR, which I think everybody would call spintronics, to tunneling AMR, which everybody would call spintronics, to this chemical potential AMR. It's exactly the same principle, just making it simpler and simpler in terms of physics, and you end up with a device where there is no transport of spin at all, not even magnons, but certainly not carriers carrying it. You just rotate the magnetization in a gate, and you control a transport in a completely normal transport channel. So maybe definitions, terminology is not that important. What I think is important, that you can make a spintronic device in which you completely decouple the magnetic or spin part from the transport. So now you can put on this very high mobility channel. You can put, graphene if you want. Anything you can put on this, and you can control it by your spin. So in spintronics, in current spintronics, there are certain limitations that you cannot get very high mobilities if you work with platinum, if you work with ferromagnets. They are bound to be lower mobility than your highest mobility transistor. Here, this problem is removed.
I'm sorry, Thomas.
Yes.
But I don't understand this. The single electron transistor, how do you open or close these additional channels for transport?
Okay, so
pure capacitive coupling.
Yes.
So spins should not matter there.
Yeah. So what happens here is the following. You have a normal single electron transistor, and you can apply a normal gate voltage. And then you can open and close. This is the normal functionality. You change the gate voltage, and you change the single electron. You get the Coulomb oscillations. Okay. What happens is that when you change the orientation of your magnetization, what happens is, I don't have the slide here because I don't want to go into details, but what happens is that you change the position of your chemical potential without changing the number of carriers in your system. It's basically because you rotate your magnetization, your band structure has spin orbit coupling, it's squeezed, you somehow squeeze your band structure, and to have the same number of particles, your chemical potential drops or moves up. But the chemical potential here in this gate, but because externally you keep this thing at a constant electrochemical potential, what's going to happen is that this device automatically will move charge from one side to another. So you're controlling the number of electrons you have on this channel just by shifting the chemical potential in this capacitively coupled gate. Okay? And so that's what happens here. This is at a fixed, This is at a fixed gate voltage. Okay, so you fix that, but you are moving charge in and out by moving your chemical potential.
May I ask a question here again? Does that mean you always have to wait to reach steady state, and you have to, so there is kind of charge transport in your system, no?
Oh, no, this thing is immediate.
Immediate
in a sense, this is connected to a big reservoir, right? So once you rotate a magnetization, it will immediately pick up the surface charge on your electrode. So it depends on how big it is, if you have capacitive coupling, if you have some losses in your system. But this is just how you do the wiring. So Yeah, that's what I was just going to get to the point. So here, as you see, I can shift my Coulomb blockade oscillations by, let's say, a half of the period, maybe a quarter of the period. It's good enough to have a big variations. But in fact, in gallium manganese arsenide, you can calculate it, and the shifts are of the order of 100 microvolts. Okay? So this is not a big thing. This is not something that you can really easily control other transistors, and that's why we chose this single electron transistor, which is an ultra-sensitive electrometer, right? But the next step was this one. We had this system, iridium manganese, and we used the same system here as it is, iridium manganese with the MgO and platinum on top. We used it as a floating gate in this capacitive structure and did exactly the same experiment. We rotated the staggered moments in the antiferromagnet and then measured again the single electron transistor. York had a detailed talk about this device, so I don't want to go into the details of it. Just want to highlight this point that you were just asking about. What we saw in this was an enormous effect, where actually by rotating those staggered moments, we were able to go through 7 periods of the gate voltage periods on this single electron transistor, which if you turn into this into numbers, was 130 millivolts change induced by rotating the magnetization. We can just follow this. You change the angle and you see how that changes here. We do not know, to be honest, where this comes from. Because if you calculate the change in the chemical potential in iridium manganese with standard DFT codes, it's always a question how you calculate it, because it's a little subtle question. In iridium manganese, you get something of the order of maybe few millivolts changes, not much more. So this is much more than you would just expect for iridium manganese. And certainly, the fact that we have this platinum plays a role that, but we don't understand. But that's one challenge, I think, for ab initio theories, because if you there's not much literature about anisotropies in the chemical potential. I mean, everybody calculates magnetic anisotropies, and the chemical potential anisotropy is embedded in those calculations. But people don't take this number out because I think automatically they were considering it's a small shift. But as you see, an experiment, you can make a structure where the shift is enormous, and what we're doing now, we're taking now the same structure and we're going to deposit a field effect transistor, maybe a graphene flake or something, because with 130 millivolts, you should be able to close and open a normal field effect transistor at room temperature. So that's type of answer to your question. It has to be floating, and I can get into the details why, but...
what does it mean, floating?
Well, it means that there is another. So this is in the middle. Then there is a capacitive coupling to the SCT, and then there is another capacitive coupling to another back electrode. Because if you would contact directly this stack, what you would directly contact is this platinum, and this platinum will screen whatever happens when you rotate the magnetic moments. So we understand that part, and we try that obviously experimentally. That you have to have it floating. If you connect it directly, you eliminate completely the effect, which also tells us that this is not an artifact. It's a real effect. There's a real solid experimental effect, and we have no idea where this such a huge shift can originate.
Do you think that the MgO barrier, that tunneling plays a role, and that you have like a filter? And
we just that's what we're.
Two states,
that's the only explanation we have, because we tried everything. We removed the MgO. We did experiment with just iridium manganese. We saw very nice shifts, but of the order of millivolt.
And continuous change on the MgO thickness give exponential decay?
Yeah, we have a set of samples, and now it's not that easy to do all these single electron transistors, but certainly this is on our, we're trying to, both theoretically and experimentally, to get to the bottom of this. But what is experimental fact is that you can get this. Obviously, this was observed by accident, because we were supposed to do this with just iridium manganese, and we used the wrong wafers, with MgO and platinum on top. But it was a lucky accident.
So as part of the discussion on the common, that seems pretty much the same physics as what other people call VCMA, voltage control magnetic anisotropy, and also MgO, 450 junctions. It's reciprocal, but it's the same, sounds like the same physics.
How do you call it, voltage control?
VCMA, voltage controlled magnetic anisotropy.
Well, I don't think it's this, because the voltage control and magnetic anisotropy.
Same thing. If you have this MA, you have also reciprocal effect, which means if you change direction of the ferromagnet, that will charge the capacitor, charge you.
Well, the way I understand these experiments, first of all, I don't think that they're clearly understood, because what you have is a thin ferromagnet, you apply a voltage to it, and you think that because of the electrostatic voltage, you're changing somehow the occupation of the orbitals, and that changes the magnetic anisotropy. Right. Alternatively, you can have piezo, maybe you're just stressing it, and that would also give you an anisotropy. So I think
whatever it is, it has a reciprocal, which is exactly of this form. Namely, if you take that, that's the same junction.
It isn't.
And you rotate magnetization, you will charge the capacitor.
It is not exactly the same thing because what you get in, at least from the understanding, they are, or the interpretation they are providing, is that this electric field changes the magnetic anisotropy. Okay. In our case, we're not changing magnetic anisotropy.
No. I'm saying that it's not. I'm not talking about the interpretation. I'm talking about the phenomenology. This is coupling between magnetization and the electric field, or the charge induced in that capacitor. And you know, if you can experimentally show you have one, then you must have the other. This is the basically just looking at the reciprocal of the same.
Okay. So from that broad perspective, yeah, maybe.
Phenomenologically, if you take that very, you know, just put MgO and coffee B and you rotate coffee B, you will see the same sort of thing.
I have to ask the audience about, we could not finish the talk yet. Time is nearly over.
I think the time is up. I was just going to say that, you know, I didn't make it anywhere I was planning to, but.
Continue.
Yeah, let's continue. I got a few more slides.
What? Yeah, we have 3/4 of an hour.
No, it's really up to you. I can stop at any point.
Because questions in the middle of it, too, not just even half an hour. So it's okay.
But then I also ask another question. You had also a sample that is aluminum?
Sorry?
You had a sample with aluminum balance instead of MgO before? Did aluminum work as well? This is my question. And
you mean for the tunneling magnetoresistance? Yeah. Well, we did not. We had.
Now, this effect, I'm asking.
Well, this effect, what it has is there's always aluminum barrier between the electrode and the SCT channel. So
but this is the unimportant.
This is
one.
The,
I mean, yeah. This barrier.
This
is
small
MgO.
One. In our sample so far, it's always MgO. Yeah.
And is this actually from?
Yeah.
It's not work with aluminum, or with alumina, I would say, aluminum oxide.
I think there is some indication that this might be the case because for the TAMR effect, we see 160%. There's another group of guy who was in Regensburg, now is in China, and who did the same experiment but replaced MgO with alox here, and he had TAMRs of less than 1%. So I think that the thing that this is a crystalline barrier, and then there is, you know, it's important. There's K-selective tunneling. It's important for the whole thing. So anyway, should I stop? Should I put a couple more? Up to you guys.
Jump to the most exciting slide. This is the command slide.
No, I have all the slides.
You should continue for.
Continue.
Huh? Yeah, otherwise, we miss the point.
That's chaos.
There's
okay. It's okay.
There's no point. This is just an open discussion. Gallo-manganese arsenide and anomalous Hall effect. Anomalous Hall effect obviously discovered a long time ago, but I think gallo-manganese arsenide are going to play a special role in this, and that's that it's not where the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect theory was first proposed. Obviously, it was in the 50s by Luttinger, but it was, to my understanding, it was the first material where people there calculating for a specific material the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect and comparing to experiments. And as you see, there was not an extensive set of data at this point in 2002. There was just one point, and this was the theory as a function of exchange splitting of the bands and different carrier concentration. But the fact that we seem to be quite close to the experimental result in gallo-manganese arsenide by just doing the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect, you should understand that at that time, 2002, people would calculate a very complicated skew scattering, side jump. This one was nothing but taking the band structure of a clean system and calculating the barrier coverage contribution without accounting for any disorder in principle. And we were almost right on spot. Maybe it could have been coincidence. But nevertheless, this inspired to look at the same thing then in iron in transition metals. And again, there was a success. The intrinsic was anomalous Hall effect was able to explain much of the observed anomalous Hall effect in normal transition metal ferromagnets. And the another path of this was that gallium-manganese arsenide is a magnetic p-type gallium arsenide. And it has an intrinsic anomalous Hall effect, we believed at that time. So from that, there was a direct suggestion that if you take a non-magnetic p-type gallium arsenide, this brother material to that, it should have an intrinsic spin Hall effect. Okay? And this, in fact, was the interpretation of the other of the two first experimental discoveries of spin Hall effect. This one was in a p-type gallium arsenide. The Absalon group had an n-type with weak spin orbit coupling, it must be extrinsic. This one was a p-type quantum well, two-dimensional Hall gas with a strong spin orbit splitting, and the interpretation was based on the intrinsic. One question is whether it's wrong or right, but certainly it went to then using this theory of intrinsic spin Hall effect in metals. And eventually, we know that this is all what are now people talking about in these bilayers, where this is the intrinsic spin Hall effect in platinum, which is able to switch this emerald. And the final point I want to make, why we are still keeping gallium-manganese arsenide in our chamber, is is this experiment, the spin orbit torque. I think here gallium-manganese arsenide really plays a unique role. There was nothing between gallium-manganese arsenide when you talk about spin orbit torque. The reason is, why this is a nice material, it has this strong exchange splitting, strong spin orbit coupling, that's all fine. But it has one extra feature, and that's it's a zinc blend structure. And zinc blend structure has a broken inversion symmetry already in the bulk. If you look through your table of ferromagnets, you're not going to find that many ferromagnets that have broken inversion symmetry in bulk. All the iron, cobalt, etc., they are now nicely inversion symmetric material. Gallium manganese arsenide isn't. This used to be an inversion point in diamond structure, but because this is a zinc blend with the two atoms being different, it breaks the symmetry. But if you have a broken inversion symmetry, that implies that by running an electrical current through a uniform magnet, through the inversion symmetry breaking and spin orbit coupling, you can get a non-equilibrium spin polarization which can exert a torque on the magnetization. And that has been predicted for gallium manganese arsenide and eventually observed in bulky gallium manganese arsenide. And then you obviously know very well that there was this then path in the metals where people say, hey, we do not have a broken inversion symmetry in our cobalt or iron, but we have a broken inversion symmetry due to this interface. So the same type of physics should apply, and then these experiments are explained in terms of the spin orbit torque and alternatively, spin Hall effect. So the point that I try to highlight to you why we're keeping the gallium manganese arsenide still in our lab is that we believe that it's still, this material is an ideal one which just keeps on inspiring also all these discussions in metals. Because we have the broken inversion symmetry already in the bulk, when there is a discussion whether something originates from spin orbit torque at the interface or spin Hall from the paramagnet, you always have to have the interface to have this discussion flowing. But if you have a bulk broken inversion symmetry, you can do spin orbit torque. There's no spin Hall effect, but you can do the spin orbit torque here without having an interface. So you know that it's just the spin orbit torque. And then from this, you can then just see that you can have also these intrinsic anti-damping-like spin orbit torque, which is just the brother of the intrinsic spin Hall effect. And that effect, now you can prove that it does exist in this material. And from this, you can now get a better understanding also from what's going on in this material. So just to conclude, because obviously I didn't manage to say virtually anything about this material, I just want to point out that all what I was just showing you so far about gallium manganese arsenide, surprisingly, I mean, it's a ferromagnetic semiconductor. But all these things, AMR, anomalous Hall effects, spin orbit torque, they actually do not rely on the fact that you have a semiconductor. You just have a nice bent ferromagnet, which is a nice property, strong spin orbit, strong exchange splitting, broken inversion symmetry. But the fact that you realize the system in a semiconductor host is not, has not been utilized in all these studies. So the final slide, if I can, to show you that there are in gallium manganese arsenide studies where you do utilize the fact that you have a host, which is a semiconductor. And that's in optical studies. So what has been observed in gallium manganese arsenide was the all optical counterparts to what we know are the electrical spin transfer or spin orbit torque. By counterpart, I mean that instead of injecting electrically the spin polarized carriers in the system, you inject them optically here. So instead of doing this electrical experiment, you just have a pulse of a circularly or linear polarized pulse, a femtosecond pulse, and then you exert the torque on the magnetization, and then you can follow the free precession of your magnetization. So all these experiments have been shown, and what they utilize here is that you have a host, which is a semiconductor, and when you shine light above the band gap, you create polarized holes and electrons through the selection rules, and those non-equilibrium photocarriers can then exert the same type of torques as in the electrical experiments. The only difference is that here you're sort of bound to the time scales of nanoseconds. Here you can go all the way down to femtoseconds. So I think I have to stop here.
Okay. Thank you very much for the talk. Questions, remarks, Gary?
You showed this comparison between experiment and theory for the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect. And there's just one point, which of course proves nothing. But with this material, you have, of course, many parameters. You can shift Fermi energy, mm-hmm. and you can put strain and stress on it.
Yeah.
So there is a real landscape to test.
Yes. And there has been, so there's been much more. So this was just one point. But then there was a very systematic study of the anomalous Hall effect in Gell-Meganis RSNI. I'm sure that Cairo and Sonoda here? No. Have it described in their review article. So there's been a very systematic study. And it's been shown that for the metallic, more metallic samples, it does scale like the intrinsic. It looks like the intrinsic is the dominant contribution. But certainly, if you go to the more insulating, there were other contributions, like you have in other ferromagnetic systems. So they were showing that in some class of these materials, it was consistent with the intrinsic. In the more insulating, it was not consistent with the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect. So yeah, there was a very systematic study following. It was not done by us.
Yeah, that was just the first paper.
For the current-induced torques in Gell-Meganis RSNI, if you take unstrained sample, you still see torques? That's what you would predict because of Zingerland structure, but does it really translate into mm-hmm. observable torques?
So the Zingerland structure alone produces turns in the Hamiltonian, which are kq. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this would be the terms which will be higher order. They're still broken inversion symmetry, but they will be weak. So if you want to have a k-linear terms like Rajba and Dresselhaus, then you have to introduce strain, because the strain...
The first experimental question, if you just take those like unstrained, or maybe it's impossible to make them unstrained. Like,
it is.
It's kind of related to Hyros.
No, it is. I can perfectly answer it.
It is that, is what he's talking about.
It's due to strain that you calculate, right?
Yeah, those are strain samples, because the linear term would not appear without that.
So your effect is due to strain.
Yes,
you calculate and what you measure is due to strain.
I can answer, I think, very precisely this question, because you can control the strain by, for example, adding phosphorus in your sample, because phosphorus is smaller, it goes for arsenic, and so you can go with phosphorus from a tensile, from a compressive to a tensile strain mm-hmm. sample, which you see very clearly from in-plane to out-of-plane magnetized material.
Oh, my question is, you emphasized the Zingerland aspect, but that's experimentally, it doesn't seem to be playing a role yet.
I'm getting to this. So when you are changing the sign of the strain, that sign of the strain determines the sign of your Dresselhaus K-linear term in your Hamiltonian, okay? If you have a Zingerland structure, and if you have a uniaxial strain in the growth direction, then you get another term in your Hamiltonian which is linear in K and has a form of a Dresselhaus. If you have a shear strain, you will get a Rajba. Mm-hmm. But for the growth strain, you will get a Dresselhaus. Now, the sign of that term depends on the sign of your strain. And the sign of that term will depend which way your torque will act. And so we had an experiment where we went from Gell-Meganis arsenide to Gell-Meganis arsenide phosphide through that transition. And you could see how the sign of the spin orbital field that you generate flips sign when you change sign of your strain.
Including going to zero.
So it obviously goes through zero. But whether in a perfectly unstrained sample it will be precisely zero or will be slightly off zero, which will be due to these K cube terms if you want, that I think would be always beyond any experimental resolution.
What you're saying is the Zingerland aspect that you emphasize does not really play that much.
Without that Zingerland aspect, the strain will not introduce this Rajba and Dresselhaus term. That's the point. If you would not have the broken inversion symmetry in the bulk, then strain will not help you. If you take cubic iron,
strain from asymmetrically, just from one side, like almost from a substrate or something.
But this effect works in bulk. Okay, the whole epilayer, the whole 50 nanometer epilayer is strained with a uniform strain across the whole structure. Okay, and without the zinc blend, you will not get it. So that's the point. We are looking at this effect in bulk, not at interfaces, just not to be confused with what's going on at the interface.
There might be changes at interfaces since also your model Hamiltonian is the K-cube term, which makes the warping of the spin moments out of plane. So this would, you wouldn't have that property in the same way at interfaces.
Well, I would probably be always very careful talking about interfaces with Gallium in this arsenal, first of all, because we know that when we grow it on a substrate, the first few nanometers are dead. The top nanometers are heavily oxidized dead. So, and it's still kind of a semiconductor in a sense that there is a depletion thickness, which is about a nanometer. So it's not purely metallic like you're used to metal. So putting an interface to that, you would have to be careful with what's really going on at the interface. There would probably be some barrier at the interface, some shocking area if you put that on the metal. But you don't have to do that. That's the privilege we have in gammas. We can study this in bulk. So.
What other question?
What is the maximum value of Rashleva effect in this by spring so far?
Yeah. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I can give you the number.
Is it strong or before the crystal or the system breaks and
Well, what I can tell you is that the spin orbit torque fields that we can generate in those materials are about one or two orders of magnitude larger than what you get in those transition metals. Okay? So all these current-induced spin-orbit torque fields that have been seen by Miron, etc. If you look at the numbers of the fields in gallium manganese arsenide, first of all, the current is smaller, so you may be confused with the absolute numbers because we run the currents at two orders of magnitude lower than in transition metals. But when you recalculate it per applied electric field, then the fields are about two orders of magnitude stronger here than in metals. So it's a strong effect that you have. But I can give you the numbers.
And did you see something strange in the optical response? I mean, in the presence of Rashleva effect.
So in the optical response, if we talk about the, let's say, the spin orbit guy, okay, that's the one which is due to spin orbit. The spin transfer where you just pump it with a circuit polarized light is just non-relativistic. You know, it's just like spin transfer torque. There is nothing dramatic. Here, the spin orbit torque. If you compare it with the electrical and the optical, the difference is that, let's say, in the simplest theory, to get the electrical spin orbit torque, what you have is the drift. So you're basically redistributing carriers from one side to the fermion to the other one, and that's why you have to have a broken inversion symmetry. That's why you have to have Rajbad-Reslow or some terms in Hamiltonian which break the inversion symmetry, because you're redistributing the carriers, you know, unidirectionally from one side to another. If you do the optical experiments where we see also the torque with a linearly or unpolarized light, what happens is that you have these photo holes. So you have the transient increase of hole concentration, but without any specific drift. So as long as you have spin orbit coupling, so that once you populate more of those holes, they will change the net spin polarization, and that would exert a torque on your magnetization. But you do not have to have broken inversion symmetry. So in our optical experiments, we don't rely on these effects. So they are, in some sense, more robust here. And then that's why you should be able to see these effects also in crystals, which do not have a broken surface, because you're just inflating the Fermi surface for a moment until these guys recombine with traps or electrons.
If not, let's thank the speaker again for the interesting talk.